a relationship where you slide into insecurity and get stuck in demon dialogues. This will allow you to figure out detours and shortcuts that lead you back into safe connection, celebrating the positive moments, big and small. This involves, first, reflecting on the moments in your daily lives that foster openness and responsiveness and reinforce your understanding of the positive impact you have on each other. And second, articulating the turning points in your recent relationship history when your love intensified. Planning rituals around the moments of separation and reunion in your daily lives to mark recognition of your bond, support, and responsiveness. These rituals are a way of holding your relationship safe in a distracting and chaotic world. Helping each other identify the attachment issues in recurring differences and arguments, and deciding together how to diffuse these issues up front to deliberately create emotional safety and trust. This will allow you to resolve problems without letting hot attachment issues get in the way. I call this the safety first strategy. Once emotional safety is established, one partner can bring up a problem in softer, less aggressive ways, and the other partner can stay emotionally engaged in the discussion, even if he or she does not agree with the view that is being presented. Creating a resilient relationship story. This story describes how the two of you have built and are continuing to build a loving bond. It tells how you get stuck in conflict and distance, and how you've learned to repair rifts, reconnect, and forgive hurts. It is a story about falling in love again and again. Creating a future love story. This story outlines what you want your bond to look like 5 or 10 years down the road, and how you'd like your partner's help in making the vision a reality. Conversation 7 is built on the understanding that love is a continual process of seeking and losing emotional connection and reaching out to find it again. The bond of love is a living thing. If we don't attend to it, it naturally begins to wither. In a world that is moving ever faster and requiring us to juggle more and more tasks, it is a challenge to be present in the moment and to tend to our own and our partner's need for connection. This final conversation asks you to be deliberate and mindful about your love. Let's see how this works in action. Danger point detours. Small moments of danger are easy for Inez and Fernando to identify. They had been doing the protest polka for years, a polka made wilder by Fernando's excessive drinking and Inez's flamboyant threats and vengeful flirting. Now, in this conversation, Inez can tell Fernando, "When you go still and turn away from me, that still freaks me out. I want to be able to tell you then, 'Hey, Fernando, please can you stay with me here?' Do you think you could hear that? That would really help me. I don't think my anxiety would get away from me then." Fernando, in turn, tells Inez that what he wants is for her to simply say she's mad at him and state exactly what has upset her, rather than immediately throw out ultimatums. Both agree that these detours could help each of them keep their emotional balance and stay out of negative spirals. Another couple, Christine and Darren, had nearly divorced over his infidelity. "I think we're recovering from the affair," she tells him, "but I want you to know that right now even the slightest suggestion that we may not be having enough sex makes me want to run and hide. Just for a second, the fear that you will always want more than I can give just leaps out at me. It doesn't take over anymore, but I still feel sick to my stomach at that moment." Darren responds, "I understand. When I made that kind of remark the other night, it was my clumsy way of trying to tell you that I desire you. How can I help here?" Christine, obviously relieved, murmurs, "Maybe just tell me right off the bat that the sex we have is good and that you're happy to be with me." He smiles and replies, "I can do that." Celebrating moments of connection. Mostly, we don't tell our partners the specific small ways that they touch us with a spontaneous word or gesture and create a sense of belonging. Fernando, with a little embarrassment, confesses that when Inez, after all they had been through, introduced him to a colleague by saying, "And this is my dear one, my husband," he melted inside. It made him feel that he was precious to her. He thinks of it every day. No one forgets the turning points when love suddenly comes into sharper focus. These ARE moments stay with us, and it's important to share them. Kay tells Don, "A key moment for me in healing our rift was that night when, even after 45 years of being married to me, you told me how much it means to you that I hold your hand. You always reach out your hand, and I guess sometimes I take it and sometimes I don't. When you told me how important it was for you that I take your hand, how for you that means that we're together, that we can do anything, I was touched. I suddenly saw you as someone who needed me, rather than this big dominating man who liked making up rules." In a session with another couple, we're discussing how Lawrence's depression has devastated his life. "I don't think I would have made it without you," he tells his wife Nancy. "Even though I was so withdrawn, you kept being there for me. That day when I went for that job interview and they gave the job to that other guy, and I came home feeling like the biggest failure in the world, do you remember what you said?" Nancy shakes her head. "You kissed me and said, 'You're my guy, no matter what. We'll make it through. I love you, mister.' I'll always remember that. And it still helps me when things get rough and I doubt myself." Even when partners are caught in demon dialogues, one of them can make a leap of empathy that just takes my breath away. I encourage them to hold on to that moment like a light in the dark as they struggle to renew their relationship. Maxine, who's usually angry at Rick for his silences, suddenly very quietly tells him, "I think I understand. You look so calm, but you're scared. You're that little lonely boy I see in that picture of you as a kid we have on the fireplace. The loneliest boy in the world. You never belonged anywhere. So now here you are with me, the most talkative woman ever, and I overwhelm you. So you just go inside and try to calm yourself down. That's so sad. You must still be very lonely in there somewhere." Rick remembers this as the moment when he suddenly felt seen and understood, that although his wife was angry with him, she loved him. A major part of keeping your love alive is to recognize these key moments of connection and hold them up where you both can see them, just as we do with family photographs of good times. They remind us of how precious our relationship is and what close connection feels like. They remind us of the simple ways that we can transform our partner's world with the power of our caring. Marking moments of separation and reunion with rituals. Rituals are an important part of belonging. They're repeated, intentional ceremonies that recognize a special time or connection. Rituals engage us emotionally and physically so that we become riveted to the present moment in a positive way. Religion has used ritual forever. I remember a famous study led by psychologist Alfred Tomatis of a group of clinically depressed monks. After much examination, researchers concluded that the group's depression stemmed from their abandoning a twice-daily ritual of gathering to sing Gregorian chants. They had lost the sense of community and the comfort of singing together in harmony. Creating beautiful music together was a formal recognition of their connection and a shared moment of joy. Among all primates, meeting and separation are key attachment moments. We recognize this with our children when they're small. We habitually kiss them goodbye and hold and greet them when they return to us. Why not take the time to formally recognize our relationship with our lover in the same way? Regular small gestures that convey the message, "You matter to me," go a long way in keeping a relationship safe and sound. Partners sometimes have a hard time recognizing these separation and reunion rituals. Joel looks blank when I ask him to identify such ceremonies in his marriage to Emma. He tells me, "Hell, I know that the dog always flings herself around and greets me when I come home, and I always sit and pat her for a bit, but I guess I go a bit unconscious with Emma. What do I notice and what do I deliberately and regularly do from day to day that kind of keeps us humming along? I'm not sure." As he scratches his head, Emma giggles and then helps him out. "You silly, it's not just the dog. Except when we lost each other for a while, you always walk into the kitchen. You say real soft, 'How's my sunshine?' And then you pat me, too, usually on my backside. And I like that a lot. I count on it." Joel looks relieved and tells her, "Oh, right. Good. Well, from now on, maybe we should make that 2 pats and a kiss. For you, I mean, not the dog." What you don't recognize slips away. Distressed partners sometimes complain bitterly about the loss of these small rituals. Kathy tells Nick, "You don't come and hold me before you leave in the morning. In fact, you don't even say goodbye anymore. It's as if we're roommates. We live in totally separate worlds, and that's fine with you." After a number of ARE conversations, Kathy and Nick decide to reinstate this ritual and to embellish it a little with questions about what the other person is going to do during the day. Sometimes we extend these rituals into family life. I can remember Sunday supper changing from a special twosome meal to a family event when my kids came along. I also remember my son many years later complaining, "I'm busy. Why do we have to have these Sunday suppers anyway?" My small daughter replied witheringly, "'Cause it's Sunday and we're a family and that is special, stupid." I help couples design their own bonding rituals, especially recognizing moments of meeting and separation or key times of belonging. These are deliberately structured moments that foster ongoing connection. Here are some that come up again and again. Regularly and deliberately holding, hugging, and kissing on waking, going to sleep, leaving home, and returning. Writing letters and leaving short notes for each other, especially when one person is going away or when a couple have come together after a spat or a time of distance. Participating in spiritual or other rituals together, such as formally meeting for special family meals, planting the first spring flowers in a family garden, praying, or attending religious events together. Habitually calling during the day just to check in and ask after the other person. Creating a personal sharing ritual, that is, a time that is just for sharing personal things and connecting, not for problem-solving or pragmatic discussions. Pete and Mara have a daily connection ritual that starts when one of them asks, "So how are you right now?" Or, "So how are we doing together?" to shift the conversation away from other issues. Sarah and Ned have a specific weekly time. On Friday night after supper, they linger over coffee for at least 30 minutes. They call it their share time. Arranging a special time just to be together. For example, Sunday morning to have breakfast in bed without the kids, or shifting schedules to eat breakfast together every day. Maintaining a regular date night, even if only once a month. Once a year, taking a class together, learning something new, even doing a project together. Recognizing special days, anniversaries, and birthdays in very personal ways. When I'm tempted to play down these kinds of acknowledgments with my loved ones, I always remember they're concrete symbols of the fact that they exist in my mind and that this is what secure attachment is all about. Deliberately deciding to attend to your partner's daily struggles and victories and validating them on a regular basis. As we discussed earlier, small comments such as, "That was hard for you to do, but you went for it," or you worked so hard on that project, no one could have tried harder, or I really saw you struggling to be a good parent there, are nearly always more effective than concrete advice. We often give our children this validation, but forget to give it to our partner. Taking opportunities to publicly recognize your partner and your relationship. This can take the form of a ceremony, such as a renewal of vows, or it can be a simple thank you to your partner in front of friends for making a wonderful supper or helping you reach a personal goal. Some partners need these kinds of formal structured arrangements to shake a habitual lifestyle that makes any kind of close connection almost impossible. Sean and Amy, working hard to move from mutual withdrawal into a much closer connection, realized that they had created lives so consumed by career demands, long commutes, and kids' activities that even on weekends they were hardly ever together in the same room for more than 10 minutes. Chronic, obsessive overwork and burnout have become part of our culture. We think it's normal. Juliet Shore, professor of sociology at Boston College, notes in her book, The Overworked American, that the United States, and Canada is similar, is the world's standout workaholic nation, leading other countries in the number of days spent on the job and the number of hours worked per day. The Chinese get 3 weeks of mandated holiday. Most Europeans take 6, but Sean was a typical American. He worked every weekend, was on call for any accounting or fiscal crisis in his company, and took his BlackBerry and his computer on his annual 2-week family holiday. Cecile Andrews, a leader in the voluntary simplicity movement, reports in her survey that North American couples spend an average of 12 minutes a day talking together. Sean and Amy estimated that for them, 5 or 6 minutes was more accurate, and that their talk was mostly about scheduling and chores. Lovemaking was a non-issue. They were always too tired. They decided to put their relationship first. In Sean's accounting terms, they would take care of their main investment. This meant cutting back on the kids' activities, setting up a monthly date, creating time on Sunday mornings to make love, and getting up 3 mornings a week to have breakfast together. Amy works at home, so Sean phones during the day just to say hello, sometimes calling her sexy names. If anyone with Amy asks who's on the phone, Amy says, "It's the relationship repair man." This couple has taken back their time and deliberately found ways to nourish their relationship so it can grow and deepen. Safety first. Sorting out attachment issues from practical problems so that the latter can be easily tackled together is a key part of keeping your love strong. In our very first research study using EFT in the 1980s, we found that the couples who learned to reach for each other and create a more secure bond rapidly became skilled at solving the everyday problems that had plagued their relationship. They were suddenly cooperative, open, and flexible. We understood that this was because mundane problems were now just that. They were no longer the screen on which partners' attachment fears and unmet needs played out. Jim and Mary can now discuss Jim's deep sea diving trips without getting caught in demon dialogues. But it was not so long ago when just the mention of these trips would spark Mary's rage and anxiety at Jim's macho distancing and crazy risk-taking. Now, when the logistical difficulties around Jim going on a long diving trip come up, Jim first asks Mary if she needs some help feeling safe in this conversation. Does she have any feelings that she needs to share? Mary appreciates being asked and says that she is a little afraid. She no longer feels deserted when Jim goes on these trips, but she still feels anxious about them. She brings up that one of Jim's diving buddies is well known for being reckless. Jim assures her he will absolutely follow the safety rules that they had already agreed on, and he also offers to forego the trip if the diving team really worries Mary. Mary feels heard and reassured and so can stay open to hearing how this trip is special to her husband. Then, together, in about 10 minutes, they solve the significant practical problems involved in Jim taking this trip. I encourage couples, as part of their planning for the future, to take an ongoing problem, such as a wife wanting her husband to be a more involved parent, and first have an ARE conversation around the issue, sharing the attachment needs and fears that this topic brings up. Then they can move into defining the pragmatic problem and consider solutions as a team. Janet used to complain to her husband Morris that he never helped in setting limits for their son. Morris would promptly dismiss her concerns and withdraw. Now she begins by expressing her vulnerability.
"I don't feel like I'm being a good mom here," she says. "It's so hard for me to really set limits for the kid. And I feel like I flip between being a harridan and a wimp. I get overwhelmed by it all. It never ends, setting rules, dealing with his evasions, talking to the school, driving him to all these appointments. I get angry, but it's because I really need your help here. I can't do this all by myself. I know you withdraw in frustration, but when you do that, it leaves me alone and overwhelmed. Can we please find a way to do this together?"
Morris, who now generally feels reassured that his wife values and depends on him, hears her and responds to her distress. They acknowledge that they both get overwhelmed by the demands of parenting and need each other's support. They define the problem as their son's over-involvement with a fast-living set of friends, and they decide jointly to set some limits. They talk specifically about how to support each other in conversations with their son when he does not respect these limits. A conversation about how to parent together is manageable. A dialogue that slips into desperate abandonment rage or hopeless evasiveness will never end in workable solutions. The essence of good problem solving is being able to stay focused and flexible. Emotional safety promotes a team approach and creative problem-solving. Countless studies link emotional safety and secure connection to our ability to assert our needs, empathize with others, tolerate ambiguity, and think clearly and coherently. It makes sense to take care of the hot bonding issues hiding out in pragmatic problems first, before trying to find workable solutions. Sometimes just clarifying the emotional music playing when a topic comes up changes the problem itself. When Hallie pressures Don to commit to infertility procedures, he balks. They frame the problem in a number of ways, as a power struggle, a difference in the desire for children, Don's selfishness, Hallie's neediness, and their lack of fit as a couple. This is indeed an overwhelming problem. In an ARE conversation, the problem shifts and shrinks. Don is able to talk about how Hallie's obsession with having a child leaves him feeling superfluous.
"Sometimes I get scared that I'm just a sperm bank to you," he says. "I need to know that I matter to you just for me."
Once Hallie and Don can talk about this, and Don is reassured that her desire for a child is part of her love for him, the problem shrinks down to an issue of timing. Don realizes that if they could be together for another year to solidify their relationship, he would feel more willing to go through medical procedures to conceive a child. Hallie agrees. Creating a resilient relationship story. When couples are caught in demon dialogues, there's often no coherent story. Only a kind of "what is happening to us" confusion. Partners' stories can be garbled and one-sided. Partners will tell me that everything is fine in the relationship and then slip into raging at each other's insensitive blaming. They say they want caring, but then tell a story of rejecting each other's caring overtures. The emotional volatility destroys their sense of their history and their ability to create a consistent storyline. But when partners tune into each other and feel felt,
It helps them reach a state of balance, physiologically and emotionally, so that they can order information in their minds and create coherent stories of their emotions and relationship. We use stories to make sense of our lives, and we use stories as models to guide us in the future. We shape stories, and then stories shape us. Once partners feel safe with each other, they can create a clear story of their relationship and figure out how to recover from disconnections and make their bond stronger. This not only sums up their past in a way that makes sense, it gives them a blueprint for the future. Your resilient relationship story should recap how you both have been stuck in insecurity and then found ways to move out of those mires together. Nicole and Bert described such wildly different versions of their relationship when they came to see me that neither of them recognized the other's version as having any validity at all. They were each living in a different marriage, and neither of their accounts made much sense. But a few months later, with their connection much more secure, they were able to create a clear, logical story of how their problems evolved and how they had reclaimed their marriage. They called it How N and B Conquered Demons and Distance and Created the Ultimate Cuddle. "Well, we fell in love instantly," Bert begins, "and even though we didn't know what we were doing, neither of us having experienced a real good relationship, even with our parents, we did pretty well. We loved each other. But then when our three girls came along, things got pretty stale and cold between us. Nicole's territory was the home, and mine was work and sports. Then when she had those medical problems and we stopped making love, we really lost touch with each other. I guess it was my fault in a way. I didn't support her enough and retreated into my job and my buddies." "It wasn't all you, though," Nicole pipes up. "I got pretty lost and started getting on your case about everything. Then we got caught in that Nicole attack and Bert zone-out polka till all we could see was how nasty the other one was. Finally, we realized we were losing each other and worked really hard to risk sharing our hurts and our needs. We realized that both of us felt desperately lonely." Bert picks up their story. "I think the big thing that helped us was understanding how we really weren't that different after all. We were just expressing our upset differently. I had to learn how my distance really made Nicole feel vulnerable and scared. When she risked telling me that, I felt a whole new set of feelings for her." Nicole smiles at her husband and adds, "The turning point for me was when you told me that you were exhausted from hearing all the faults I had found in you and that you were just grieving and giving up on me loving you. I didn't want you to do that. So we both found a way to talk about our raw spots, reach for each other, and give each other another chance. When we went back and talked about the night our last baby was born, you helped me let go of all that old hurt and resentment. You accepted that you didn't stand up to that doctor for me like I thought you should. That was so important for me. I was able to start to trust you again." Bert turns to me and laughs. "I guess we sound pretty satisfied with ourselves, but it feels like we've accomplished a lot. I feel like I have my wife back. We found our way back to being close, and I like that we can talk and say how we did it. It gives me confidence." Bert and Nicole didn't need much help putting this story together. Sometimes I prompt couples a little to articulate the elements of their story. If you need aid, I suggest that you help each other to come up with the following: 3 adjectives or images that describe your relationship when it was stalled in insecurity and negative spirals. For example, dead-ended, exhausted, a minefield. 2 verbs that capture how each of you moved in your negative dance and how you were able to change the pattern. I pushed, you turned away, but we learned to talk about how scared we were and reach out for each other. one key moment when you saw each other differently, felt new emotions, and were able to reach for each other. I remember that Saturday afternoon when I had walked out. I came back into the room and you were weeping. The look on your face really got to me. I just felt our sadness and came over and told you I wanted us to be close again and I needed your help. We had to help each other get there. Three adjectives, emotions, or images that express your relationship right now. Playful, contented, delighted, blessed, hand in hand. One thing you're doing to keep your connection with each other open and growing. Cuddling before we fall asleep. Kissing when we wake up. Marion and Steve, after successfully taking their relationship from endless bickering to safe emotional connection, come up with the following story. In the beginning, our relationship was cold, tight, and lonely, says Marion. Steve pushed and banged on the door. I just turned away and hid. We both saw the other person as the problem. But that day, when we found ourselves talking about divorce, we realized that both of us were terrified of losing the other. So we started to help each other out and take little risks to learn to trust each other. Steve now chimes in. Talking about the times when things really turned around was the most interesting. For me, a key moment was when Marion cried and told me that she'd always believed that she wasn't pretty, clever, or sexy enough for me, and she was so sorry that I had ended up feeling lonely, that she wanted to come out and be with me, but she was afraid. I don't think I've ever felt closer to her than in that moment. I never understood how she felt inside, that she wasn't trying to hurt me when she got all distant. And I never understood the impact of my angry comments on her, how small she felt. I ask, how about for you, Marion? Do you remember a time when new emotions came in, a time that moved you into a different place with Steve? Oh, yes, she replies. It was one night when we were talking about his pushing me till I blow, and he suddenly looked so sad. He told me, well, I'd rather have you mad at me than just not care at all. At least if you're mad, I know I matter to you. And I got that. Now when I start to doubt everything again, I go back to that moment in my head. It calms me down. My big, powerful husband needs that from me. Amazing, isn't it? She tips her head to one side and smiles as if she's just discovered the most exquisite secret. It's a secret that changes her universe. Steve and Marion have no trouble coming up with positive images of their present relationship. They agree that the image that captures how they are with each other now is the image of how they greet each other in the evening and hold each other. Marion says that she feels more confident as a person since they've been able to turn their relationship around. She now feels close to Steve in a way that moves her into calm happiness. Steve chooses his words carefully. When she risks and comes close, I melt, he says, and I feel high. We have a new level of trust here. Will melt, high, and trust do? I tell him that it seems to me that they will do very nicely. I get him to ask Marion, and she replies with a broad, open smile. Then we talk about how there will be times when they miss each other's signals, find it hard to respond, and spin out into their negative cycle. They recap exactly how they can now stop the spin of negative feelings in their demon dialogues. At those times, Steve says to Marion, "We're losing it here, and we're both hurting." Marion tells me, "The only way I can really do it is to take a deep breath and leap." I say to Steve, this is scary. We need to slow down. They agree that they now also take time to listen and comfort each other when those feelings of hurt come up. I ask them to tell me one thing that they're doing to keep the positive cycle of reaching and connecting strong. They tell me that they write loving notes to each other every few days and stick them on pillows, in briefcases, or on dashboards. Neat. I do that for my kids sometimes. How come I never thought to do that for my husband? They also tell me that after making love, they always tell each other one thing the other had done that they had really liked. With all the fighting, they had both lost confidence in their sexual attractiveness and abilities. This was a way to support each other and get their confidence back. Creating a future love story. I ask partners to make up their future love story. We talk about what their personal dreams are for the next 5 to 10 years. The more of a safe haven we have with our loved one, the more assured, assertive, and adventurous we can be. When our loved one is by our side, we tend to have more faith in ourselves and can dream in a new, expansive way. In this story, partners relate their vision of their future relationship. They then ask each other for support and discuss how they can make it a reality together.
"Personally, I want my own company," Steve tells Marion, "even if it's small, but I can't do it without your support. And I want to do it in a way that has you feeling included, not neglected. The ideas you have are really useful to me."
When it is Marion's turn, she tells him that she's thinking maybe she can finish her degree after all, and she appreciates him offering to look after the kids during her evening classes. She then mentions how in about 5 years they might have another child. Steve rolls his eyes and pretends to fall off his chair at the mention of another baby. But he agrees that they can talk about this, although he has some fears around it. She stays engaged with him and agrees to listen to his reservations. Then we talk about how they envision their future relationship. Both want to keep the newfound closeness between them and commit to holding on to the ways they've developed to safeguard their time together. Marion tells Steve that she wants their sex life to improve and wants him to read some books on sex with her. He agrees. He wants them to spend more time together with their kids and less time with her extended family. This is hard for her, but she's able to listen to his points and move into being more open to the idea. She tells him her limits. She just cannot give up religious holidays with her family, and he respects this. She looks at me and tells me, "Not bad, huh? A few months ago, we couldn't agree on when to go grocery shopping, let alone deal with these kinds of changes and planning for the future." A safe emotional connection makes all the difference. Finally, I ask them, when they're very old, what would they like to be able to tell their great-grandchildren about their relationship? Steve says,
"I'd like to tell them that I was a good husband, and I really tried to make my wife happy, that she was the light of my life, like she is now."
Marion can't speak at this point. With tears in her eyes, she murmurs, "Ditto." Holding on to positive changes, creating new models. After Marion and Steve leave, I find myself remembering that in the early days of EFT, we didn't pay much attention to asking couples how they plan to hold on to their positive changes. I used to think that if you understood love, accepted your attachment needs, and found ways into ARE conversations, these moments would be so intoxicating that couples would naturally just keep doing them. You did not need to actively plan how to keep your love alive, but my couples have taught me differently. When you move into new ways of connecting with your partner, it's useful to take the new emotions, perceptions, and responses and integrate them into a narrative that captures all these changes. The resilient relationship story gives you a coherent way of reflecting on your relationship drama, a drama that is always unfolding, no matter how clear your focus. Couples tell me that this makes it easier for them to hold on to the positive changes they've made and gives them a model of their relationship as a safe haven that they have built together and can rebuild again and again. Partners can also call up these positive models to help them deal with moment-to-moment interactions especially when raw spots get rubbed. They help us contain the fallout when we get hurt, deal with our doubts, and remain connected. When I'm flying through turbulent skies and getting panicky, it calms me to remember how I dealt with this situation at other times and how I landed safely. A resilient relationship story is a little like that. Marion tells me at one point, "Sometimes my whole body screams at me to run, tells me that this is just like my relationship with my dad and my first husband. Then I remember times I have taken risks with Steve, and it was good. This helps me turn and take risks again, rather than lock him out. Sometimes my head tells me that it's up to him to respond, that I shouldn't have to ask. But then I remember him telling me that he doesn't know what to do unless I help him out and confide in him. It's like part of my brain says, I am in shark-infested waters here. But I bring up these positive pictures, and they remind me that I am just in a little pool and that I'm safe with Steve. New models of positive connection challenge not just our customary ways of seeing and responding to our partner, but also the templates for relationships that develop from our thousands of interactions with parents and past lovers. They change our view of close relationships and what is possible in them. They change who we are as people. I am talking about the cynical, untrusting thoughts prompted by our pasts that we aren't even aware of until they pop up when we're in a panic and cannot safely connect with our lover. Steve tells me, "Sometimes when I can't reach her, I can flip into this real negative place, and my mind tells me that all relationships are bullshit, that you can't trust or depend on anyone, and you're a fool to even try, that watching your back and being in control is the only way to live. Then I can be real hostile, and Marion has to be the enemy. But these days, Marion and I can connect, and when these ideas come up, there's another part of me that is calm and has this resilient relationship story. Or maybe it's like a movie rather than a story. I think of the images in the story we created, and that old bitterness seems to go away. I think this helps me stay more open to my wife and to other people, too." John Bowlby believed that we generalize from thousands of small interactions with those we've loved and build models of love and loving in our minds. These models guide our expectations and reactions in the present. This is fine if our models from the past are clear, coherent, and positive, but not if they're negative, confusing, and chaotic. We always have a bias in favor of what we already know. If this bias is negative, it can trap us in the habits of the past and make it difficult to stay open to positive possibilities with loved ones. Negative models tell us that closeness is dangerous and that depending on someone is foolish, or that we're unworthy and cannot expect to be loved. Positive models tell us that others are basically trustworthy, that we're lovable and entitled to caring. When we learn to foster safe, loving interactions with our partners and can integrate new experiences into models that affirm our connections with others, we step into a new world. Old hurts and negative perceptions from past relationships can then be put away and not allowed to orchestrate our way of responding to our lovers. If we look at research, like that of psychologist Mary Main at the University of California, on adults who have an inner sense of trust and security with others, the key quality of these folks is not that they always had happy relationships with parents and caregivers in the past. It's that they can be emotionally open, lucidly describe past relationships, and reflect on the good and bad experiences and make sense of them. When I encourage partners to work on integrating their new dance into a view of what it means to love and be loved, I'm encouraging them to positively reshape their unconscious blueprints for close connection with others. The new blueprint helps them to be truly present with their partner rather than fight echoes from past relationships. In a counseling session, I might say, I know your amygdala, the emotional part of your brain, is listening to new messages and responding differently here. But would you please also take this new information and order, tabulate, and store it in your prefrontal cortex, the reasoning part of your brain, for future reference? New research in neuroscience tells us that I would not just be using metaphors here. Dan Siegel, a main proponent of incorporating the new findings in brain science into our understanding of relationships, reports in his book, Parenting from the Inside Out, that mental models are ingrained in our brains in patterns of neural firing. Neurons send messages to one another, and when messages are repeated over and over again, as Canadian psychologist Donald Hebb tells us, neurons fire together and then wire together. New experiences, if they're reflected on and assimilated, can actually reshape our brains. Thus, Marion and Steve are busy translating new interactions into new pathways in their brains, pathways that reinforce their positive ways of seeing and engaging each other. I think all the ways of keeping your love alive described in this conversation help neurons wire together and create a neural net of hope and faith that will help a couple hold on to their connection in the future. In the end, all of this review, ritual, and story-making are simply ways of encouraging couples to continuously pay attention to their relationships. This attention is the oxygen that keeps a relationship alive and well. Psychologist Robert Caron, in his book, Becoming Attached, reminds us that to have a strong and lasting love that helps lovers thrive emotionally and intellectually, we don't need to be rich or smart or funny. We just have to be there, in all senses of the phrase. If we can do this, love can do more than last. It can flower again and again. Play and practice. Are there any emerging danger points in your relationship right now? Echoes of raw spots or anxieties that are just starting up? Can you pinpoint the last time you were aware of this? Your body will give you the message, now that doesn't feel good, and you'll get a sudden flood of emotion. Can you name the emotion? How can your lover help you with that? What would calm and reassure you and halt a developing negative cycle? Can you share this with your lover? Can you identify small positive moments in your relationship? These can be very small. As long as they stir your heart and bring a smile to your lips, they count. Does your partner know about these moments? Tell him or her. Can you single out the key moments in your relationship when it shifted to another level, or you or your partner took the risk of becoming more open and responsive? How did this happen? What was it that you or your partner did that allowed this to happen? Sometimes we remember a first kiss, a coming together after a big fight, or a moment when our lover moved in close and gave us just what we needed. Do you now have rituals marking belonging, separation, or reunion? Do you consciously say hello and goodbye? See if you can list these rituals with your partner. Can you create a new daily bonding ritual that will help you move into being more open, responsive, and engaged with each other? Think of a problem-solving discussion that always ends up in frustration for you and your partner. See if you can write down your attachment needs and fears that are operating just under the surface during this discussion. How could you express these to your partner? What could he or she do to help you with them? If you got this help, how do you think this would affect your discussion? With your partner, craft the beginnings of a resilient relationship story. Include how you once got stuck in a demon dialogue and how you exited the dialogue, created an ARE conversation, and renewed your sense of connection. What did you both learn from the experience? If you have a hard time building the story, discuss this with your partner and use the elements mentioned earlier in this conversation, for example, find three adjectives to describe your bond, to help you. Discussing the examples in this conversation can also help. Together, create a future love story, a description of the relationship you intend to have in 5 or 10 years. Decide on one thing you as an individual can do right now to bring this dream a little nearer and share it with your partner. How can your partner help you achieve your own personal dreams? What one small thing might you do every day to make your lover feel that you want to be there with him or her? Ask your partner what impact this would have on your relationship. You have just taken a journey through the new science of love. This science tells us that love is even more important than the sappiest love songs insist. But love is not a mystical, mysterious force that sweeps us off our feet, as those love songs suggest. It is our survival code and contains an exquisite logic that we're now able to understand. This means that a resilient, deeply satisfying love relationship is not a dream, but an attainable goal for us all. And that changes everything. Part 3. The Power of Hold Me Tight. Healing Traumatic Wounds, The Power of Love. Talking with my wife is a relief from the things that happen here, like that first breath you take when you've been underwater for too long. Joel Buchanan, U.S. soldier in Iraq, Washington Post Magazine, February 12, 2006. Whenever a few people band together and tell each other stories to try and understand their world, there are always monsters, dragons, and ghosts. They go by many names: the Wild Witch of the North, the Four-Headed Dragon, the Angel of Death. The beasts reflect our sense of just how dangerous and unpredictable life can be. When these monsters appear, we have but one saving recourse: the support and comfort of others. Even when things seem hopeless, there is solace and strength in connection. In his song "Goodnight Saigon," Billy Joel sings as a soldier in Vietnam. The chorus goes, "And we would all go down together," and the song ends up sounding like an affirmation rather than a dirge. Soldiers joined by bonds of comradeship and love will face demons that, if confronted alone, would have them running the other way. My childhood, pagan in the pub but Catholic in the classroom, was pretty safe. Still, there were dreams of purgatory and a crazy-eyed demon who looked a lot like Sister Teresa, my headmistress, calling me to account for crimes like stealing Tiffany Amos's ruler and gleefully walloping her with it when no one was looking. I used to pray to all the saints, my own personal team of saviors. They were garbed in blue and white, and every one of them looked exactly like my little English granny. My legion of grannies never failed to swoop down and rescue me. When life gets dangerous and unpredictable, we know how much we need the help of others in meeting the challenge fate has delivered. And after the fight, when we're sore or injured, and any facade of rugged self-sufficiency that we've managed to hold on to has crumbled, our need for others who care moves front and center. The quality of our central relationships affects how we face and heal from trauma, and as everything moves in a circle, trauma has an impact on our relationships with the people we love. The word trauma comes from a Latin word meaning to wound. The old idea in psychology was that only a few of us faced true trauma in our lives. But we're now starting to realize that traumatic stress is almost as common as depression. More than 12% of U.S. women in a recent large survey reported having significant post-traumatic stress at some point in their lives. Trauma is any terrifying event that instantly changes the world as we know it, leaving us helpless and emotionally overwhelmed. We've already talked about relationship traumas caused, albeit unwittingly, by lovers in Conversation 5, Forgiving Injuries. Now we're addressing even more severe wounds inflicted by people and events outside of our love relationships. Over the years, my colleagues and I have seen survivors of childhood abuse, victims of rape or assault, parents who have suffered the loss of a child, and men and women who have faced brutal illness or horrendous accidents. We've also seen police officers distressed by the death of buddies, firefighters devastated by their inability to save all those who were in peril, and soldiers haunted by the echoes of battle. If you have a responsive love partner, you have a secure base in the chaos. If you are emotionally alone, you're in free fall. Having someone you can rely on for connection and support makes healing from trauma easier. Chris Fraley and his colleagues at the University of Illinois found evidence of this in their study of 9/11 survivors who were in or near the World Trade Center. 18 months later, those who avoided depending on others were struggling with more flashbacks, hyper-irritability, and depression compared with those who felt securely attached to loved ones. In fact, the securely attached survivors, reported their friends and relatives, appeared to be even better adjusted after the attack than they were before. They seemed to have been able to rise above the situation and actually grow from it. If we cannot successfully connect with others, our struggles to cope with trauma become less effective, and our main resource, our love relationship, often begins to sink under its weight. On the other hand, facing the monster with a loved one beside us gives us the best shot at finding our strength and resilience, and standing together strengthens the bond with our partners. Locking up feelings. Even if on some instinctual level we know that we need love to heal the wounds of trauma, it's not always easy to open up and seek that caring. Often, to survive in a moment of danger, we have to freeze our feelings and simply act. This is particularly true for those who step into harm's way in their everyday jobs. A New York firefighter tells me, "When we're going to a fire, especially if it's a big one, I'm pumped. We're screaming through the streets on our way to saving people. We know how to do it. In the fire, you just act. There's no room for fear or doubt. And even if you feel it, you just push it aside." The problem comes afterward. It's sometimes hard for us to acknowledge that we're wounded. We think this makes us smaller or less admirable as human beings. Many of us keep those fears and doubts locked up inside, believing that letting ourselves feel is a sign of weakness that will undermine our strength when the monster returns. Some of us think that shutting down and keeping the monster isolated in a box is the only way to protect our home life. Soldiers talk about a code of silence and how they have to bury their deployment experiences to protect not just themselves, but their loved ones. They're encouraged to do so. An Army chaplain told me, "We tell the soldiers, don't tell your wives about your bad experiences. It will only scare and hurt them. And we tell the wives, don't ask questions about battle. It will only bring those painful times back for your husbands." But monsters don't stay in boxes. They get out. Such events forever alter how we see the world and how we see ourselves. Trauma shatters our assumptions that the world is just and life is predictable. After such experiences, the way we are with our lovers and the emotional signals we send them will be different. We're changed by the heat of the dragon's breath. A Canadian peacekeeper in Africa who had to stand and watch women and children be massacred finds on returning home that he cannot embrace his wife or kids. His children appear to have the faces of those who died. He's too confused and ashamed to tell his wife this. He's locked down and locked in. His wife expresses her frustration that he has never come home. He's not emotionally present, she complains. She cannot find him.
a soldier recently returned from Iraq and convalescing at home after serious surgery, is swamped by inexplicable rage when his wife steps out to go shopping. He tells her he will never trust her again. Their relationship is over. She is totally confused and then despairing. Her confusion changes.